This week on World Affairs. As the novel coronavirus continues to spread at shocking speed worldwide, what's going on inside the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia?
Saudi Arabia arrests the king's brother and other royals accused of plotting against the crown prince.
Just as the pandemic has suddenly driven down global demand for oil, Saudi Arabia and Russia got into a price war that's flooding the market.
The Saudis have hired 16 supertankers and are loading oil onto them. They have no place to go. They have no destination.
While there's hope for an OPEC agreement on production, experts still see international oil exchanges in turmoil for some time to come. What's the impact on U.S.-Saudi relations?
So there's a lot of folks that are questioning whether or not the U.S. still needs to spend $100 billion a year protecting the Saudi Arabia and the other Persian Gulf monarchies from threats to the region.
How is Saudi Arabia managing its own COVID-19 response?
Saudi Arabia has an edge when it comes to managing large pandemics because of its management of the Hajj, the annual pilgrimage, where you have Muslims from across the globe, millions of them, visiting Mecca and Medina at the same time.
And as Yemen's brutal war enters its sixth year and the war-torn country braces against COVID-19, the United States is cutting healthcare aid.
The timing is definitely not good. Look, this is a choice between a very, very bad situation for Yemen and a really just terrible, disastrous situation for Yemen.
Hello and welcome. I'm Philip Yun, CEO of World Affairs. And now we take a deep dive into Saudi Arabia and the world oil market. Marcos Kounoulakis starts us off with some background.
Saudi Arabia's Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, known simply as MBS, has had a controversial rise to power, and he appears to be tightening his grip even more.
We begin in Saudi Arabia, where Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman has detained some of the most high-profile members of the royal family.
In March, at least 20 members of the royal family were arrested and detained. In just 3 years, MBS has silenced nearly all voices of dissent at home, with critics jailed, even killed. Most prominently, of course, Washington Post columnist Jamal Khashoggi.
Turkish officials here are convinced that the killing of Jamal Khashoggi was a premeditated murder.
And in the midst of this political turmoil, Saudi Arabia escalated regional tensions with an ongoing war in Yemen, an oil production war with Russia, and multiple proxy war fronts with Iran. The Crown Prince is now managing the country's latest war against COVID-19.
Saudi Arabia has halted international travel into the country and to Mecca over concerns about the spread of the coronavirus.
The world's last major coronavirus outbreak in 2012 began in Saudi Arabia. A faltering response allowed the Middle East Respiratory Syndrome, known as MERS, to kill several hundred people and spread across the region.
When the MERS outbreak happened in 2014, Saudi Arabia was actually criticized because it didn't take enough measures. This time we've seen Saudi Arabia actually publicly stating that it has learned from the lessons of MERS.
In February, the kingdom took the extraordinary decision to temporarily close off the holy cities of Mecca and Medina, a step which wasn't taken even during the 1918 flu pandemic that killed tens of millions worldwide. The shrines were sanitized, but remain virtually empty today. And as if shutting down Islam's holiest sites wasn't enough, it's now telling Muslims around the world to skip the annual million-man pilgrimage known as the Hajj. One video circulating has an imam crying during his call to prayer, imploring the faithful to stay and pray in their homes. Joining us to discuss all this are Deb Amos. She's an international correspondent for National Public Radio and teaches journalism at Princeton University. And Yasmin Farouk. She is a visiting fellow in the Middle East program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Yasmin, can you tell me a little bit about the coronavirus effect currently in Saudi Arabia, perhaps touching on the experience of MERS previously in Saudi Arabia, and of course, how it is that the kingdom is responding given the number of pilgrims who come to the country.
To give you a bit of a background, Saudi Arabia is faced with many challenges at the same time. So around the same week that they started their crisis management strategy for the COVID-19 outbreak in the kingdom, the Crown Prince had decided to engage in a new wave of arrests in the palace. Only this time, one of the highest level of senior princes, if not the highest, because he arrested his own uncle, the Prince Ahmed Abdulaziz, who is a brother of King Salman, so the Crown Prince's father. He also arrested a former Crown Prince that he had toppled to take his place, Prince Mohammed bin Naif, with another number of less senior princes, and even called into question some officials who are still in charge, like another second cousin of his, and another also prince who is currently the Minister of Interior. Now, this was not widely treated in Saudi media, of course. It was mainly in Western media. Also, around the same time, Saudi Arabia took the decision to flood the oil market in competition with Russia, mainly, and in what has been dubbed now the oil price war, which is a competition with Russia, but also with other producers, including shale producers, over market shares. So we've seen Saudi Arabia already increasing its production to its maximum limit, and also knocking on doors, if you want, of different countries, offering them extremely low prices. Then came the COVID-19 crisis management strategy. As you said, Saudi Arabia has an edge over other countries because it has a cumulative knowledge and experience managing Hajj. When you have millions of people coming at the same time from all over the world. The last crisis management that was not on the same international scale, because it was more local, as you mentioned, was the MERS. Saudi Arabia was criticized, but we've seen Saudi officials actually using the lessons learned, and this is according to experts from the US CDC, in order to manage the current crisis. So very early on, they have taken very extensive and expensive precautions that even shocked their own societies. So now you have curfew all over Saudi Arabia. Even the holy cities of Islam, of Mecca and Medina, are also subject to this curfew. Seasonal pilgrimage, or what is called Umrah, has been suspended. By the end of this month, the holy month of Ramadan was supposed to start. And this is an emotional issue, not only for Saudis, but for Muslims from across the globe. And Saudi Arabia has actually officially called on Muslims around the globe to delay their plans for the annual pilgrimage that's supposed to take place in July. Inside the country, I have seen them use a lot of the paternalistic statecraft that we have seen a little bit abandoned by the Crown Prince, meaning there is so much use of the king's figure as father of the nation. He made a speech in which he said, I'll talk frankly and tell you this is going to be difficult. But there was a paternalistic tone that the Crown Prince doesn't use. And they are also doubling down on a nationalist narrative and on a religious narrative about how abiding by state directives to control the crisis is something that is religious and nationalist. Of course, all of this is engulfed in a lot of propaganda that is geared towards the inside and the outside. Towards the inside, the propaganda is mainly showing, for example, the conditions in which citizens are quarantined, or even supporting very small enterprises and individuals. And towards the outside, it's kind of a rehearsal of Saudi Arabia's capacities in preparation to the G20 summit. So they have, you know, created a video promoting how Saudi Arabia is a responsible, capable state. And to be honest, they have a lot of support from the population. If you want to use the WHO assessment, their assessment of how the Saudis are governing and are managing the crisis is actually quite positive.
Very good. Yasmin, you brought in a number of issues here, from how the Saudis in their very controlled environment are able to manage an epidemic. But you have also touched on things that are happening concurrently. And Deb, I'd like to bring you into the conversation here, because one of the first things that Yasmin mentioned was essentially the move by Mohammed bin Salman, also popularly known as MBS in the West, how he has in effect worked very quickly to consolidate his power at a time when he may actually be rising to the throne. Can you give us a little bit of analysis about both him as a person and also these recent moves to whether detain or arrest members of the royal family or other types of moves he's making internationally to assert his leadership and his power?
I think it was surprising that he took such drastic measures, which coincide with their plan to tamp down the country over the coronavirus. I mean, they have stopped all flights. You can't get a taxi in Saudi Arabia. You can't get on a bus in Saudi Arabia. It is a real lockdown. Probably the only place stricter that I know is Jordan, where they've closed down the bakeries there, and it's the army that's delivering bread. I think the thing that is interesting to look at is his fight. Some people call it playing chicken with the Russians, and that is this attempt to, you know, corral the oil market by slashing prices. So at the time that you have a demand shock, you also have a price shock, and it's wreaking havoc across the region. When you have oil moving down to $20 a barrel, the role that the Gulf countries usually play in any crisis, you know, shoring up the poor Arab countries, giving humanitarian aid, nobody has any money when oil is at $20 a barrel. And even the Americans are distressed by this because it is knocking the shale oil producers in the United States. The Saudis have hired 16 super tankers and are loading oil onto them. They have no place to go. They have no destination. So you're going to see oil tankers across the world with this excess of oil. So I think that this drop in oil prices will play a role both economically and in how the pandemic plays out in the region.
Well, you know, this question of oil prices is something we'll discuss more later in the program. And it's certainly a key issue in a country like Saudi Arabia, which is so dependent for all of its revenues, other than outside of its investment and its sovereign wealth fund, on the cost of this commodity, which has, of course, in the last few years, risen to above $100 per barrel. The other things that were mentioned by Yasmin and I think are really interesting is the fact that, in fact, Saudi Arabia is still, in essence, in a state of war in many ways. There's a conflict with Yemen. And some look at this war as a proxy war between Saudi Arabia and Iran. How do you frame this particular thing? First, Deborah Amos, and then I'll turn to Yasmin.
It is true. The Yemen war is certainly a proxy war between the Saudis and Iran. I was reading a columnist in the Saudi Gazette today who is calling the pandemic the Iranian corona, and not looking at China, but looking instead at Iran. Some of the early cases in Saudi came from the eastern province. It's Shia population who had come back from Iran. That is certainly true. But Saudi has many international visitors all the time coming to the holy cities. So it's not clear where the virus came from and how it got to the kingdom. But there's no doubt that the Saudis will use this in their regional confrontation with Iran over, you know, power there. And so it's no surprise that there are Saudis who are calling it the Iranian corona.
Yasmin, maybe you could just give us a brief contextualization of what this conflict really between Saudi Arabia and Iran is about. It is really the regional conflict of note because those two powers are so dominant, both in oil markets, but also because they represent different factions of Muslim and Islam.
I think it's not a coincidence that every time there is an escalation in the Gulf or escalation between Iran and the United States, you see the Houthis also escalating against Saudi Arabia. And over the past month, we have seen an escalation against Saudi Arabia with the Houthis taking over strategic locations on the border with Saudi Arabia until we reached ballistic missiles being fired on the Saudi capital, Riyadh, that were intercepted by Patriot batteries, but also in the southwest city of Jizan. The conflict actually just turned 5 years old, and the Saudis are finally at a stage where they are ready to end it, and they know they need to end it for many reasons, one of which is the huge international pressure that is being put on them, but also the losses that they have been taking economically, but also human loss, and third of all, in terms of their reputation, their image. And this policy had started really in the aftermath of the attacks on Aramco oil infrastructure last September 2019. That, by the way, the Houthis claimed that they were the source, but, you know, the United States and Saudi Arabia said it was Iran.
And the Houthis, of course, being the dominant ethnic group living in Yemen.
They are not the dominant ethnic group. They are the group who decided to take up arms and conducted a coup d'etat that kicked what the international community considers being the legitimate government in Yemen. And in 2015, Saudi Arabia decided to intervene militarily in Yemen to restore the legitimate government that since then has been actually residing in Riyadh.
And I think it's notable also, Yasmin, to mention that the defense secretary of Saudi Arabia at the time was none other than Mohammed bin Salman, MBS.
So it is true. Saudi Arabia, to go back to your original question and this being a proxy war, Saudi Arabia has a very complex history in terms of relations with Yemen. It has always considered Yemen to be a kind of part of its own national security. It has used very traditional and not necessarily state-to-state relations in the sense that it was based on flows of money, but also men and ideology. You have intermarriages, and you also have people in the south of Saudi Arabia that share the same doctrine and ideology with the Houthis. The Houthis are closer to the Shia ideology, actually, because of intermarriages. There are transnational relations with Saudi Arabia. Now, the alliance between the Houthis and Iran, the Saudis have contributed to making it a self-fulfilling prophecy. By waging the war, and a war that they couldn't win, the Houthis actually doubled down on an alliance or their links with Saudi Arabia's foe, which is Iran. And for Iran, it's a huge victory to be able to infiltrate this direct, if you want, belt of Saudi Arabia's national security. And since then, the Iran and also its Lebanese proxy, Hezbollah, and other proxies have been helping the Houthis, arming them, and providing them with strategic guidance and so on and so forth. And so it has become today, you know, proxy confrontation between Iran and Saudi Arabia that is being playing out in Yemen.
Right. Well, you know, this whole question of the war in Yemen, we read not too long ago that the United Nations had called the Yemeni crisis and the war the world's greatest humanitarian crisis. And Deb Amos, it's not just something that we're observing through the United Nations and its outrage at this conflict, but it's a conflict that also engages the United States. It's one where the United States has actively been in support of the Saudi forces, but also plays into American engagement with Iran. Could you contextualize the dynamics of that three-party engagement, Saudi Arabia, the United States, and Iran, play out on the world stage?
Oh, thanks. That's an easy one. So I've been thinking and have been reading, and this cliche comes to my mind, which is a crisis accelerates history. And I think a couple of things are happening as MBS wages his oil war. One thing is it's already affected Aramco. You know, they are suffering because of MBS's decisions. Their stock price is falling. We saw for the first time a U.S. shale oil driller filed for bankruptcy, and it was one of the big ones. So one wonders about that relationship between Saudi Arabia and the United States. When it comes to Iran, for the first time ever, there was a Instex event. And let me tell you what that is. The EU, the British, the French, and the Germans set up an alternative trading system. They did it 18 months ago, and it was plagued with technical difficulties. The Trump administration was dead set against it. But yesterday, for the first time, they were able to complete a transaction where there would be medicines that go to Iran. It's not a game changer, but what it allows is for Europe to not only send humanitarian aid to Iran, but to send medicines that they will need for this pandemic. And that allows, say the Europeans, to give some more life to the nuclear deal. They hope that they can give it some breath for a couple of more months. And you may have noticed that the Iranians caught up in this pandemic have not changed any of the parameters for the nuclear deal. They were doing that over the summer and then they stopped. So the world is in a different moment than it was before the pandemic. And I can't see ahead that far, but you are seeing relationships change in ways that will change those relationships over time.
And of course, Iran is one of the nations that's suffering most under this coronavirus crisis. They have large swaths of their population that are affected by this. So perhaps the humanitarian approach that is also favored by Europe is something that's not so surprising in this crisis.
Yes, but they didn't have a mechanism to do it. And that's what's important here. As well, the UAE, Qatar, and Kuwait have also aided Iran. The UAE sent boxes and boxes of protective gear. And so these are new movements in the region that are noticeable. Saudi cannot ignore, you know, how much aid that Iran is getting and how much support Iran is getting, both from the EU and from some of its Gulf allies.
And I think what we're also seeing are the first inklings of an opening from the U.S. administration with Secretary Pompeo at least saying that he's open to a dialogue and certain openings to Iran during this crisis.
But here's what the administration has said. They wanted to open a humanitarian channel with the Swiss, but for it to open, Iran had to give up 5 Americans who are jailed. And now that the EU has found a mechanism, it's unlikely that Iran will take that deal.
So, Yasmin, clearly the U.S.-Iran relationship is fraught. It suffers from a history of distrust and an administration that wants to reverse what the last administration of President Barack Obama had wrought with the nuclear deal. Could you look at the U.S.-Saudi relationship and maybe explain to us not why it's fraught, but why it's relatively good and has been so good?
Sure. So over the years, this is a relationship that has been mutually beneficial to both parties, not only within their direct bilateral relations, but it also served each party in its international relations outside the relationship, meaning in international organizations, but also in places where they have asked for each other's helps outside of the Middle East and even outside of the United States. This is a relationship that started only 1 year after the birth of the Saudi state. It has never been easy. It has always had its tensions and its doubts because we're talking about two very different political and value systems. The thing is, for over a decade now, there has been changes inside both the United States and Saudi Arabia, but also in the region that has been calling for another change in the relationship itself, but the two sides have been resisting it. So let me give you an example. Over the past 10 years, for example, in the United States, there has been this debate about the need to switch attention and investment of resources from the Middle East towards Asia and the competition, what is called today under the Trump administration, great powers competition. But whether the Obama administration or the Trump administration, they haven't been able to do that, really, because you have a resistance on the other side, on the Saudi side. Saudi Arabia, despite diversifying its relationships with strategic partnership with China, but also developing relations with Russia and other emerging powers such as India, but also South Korea and Japan, South Africa, it is still heavily dependent on the United States in terms of defense, in terms of security relations. And on the other side, there has been under the Trump administration, to be honest, an underestimation of the weight that Saudi Arabia still has on the oil market. And we have seen it into play now.
Deb, you are a journalist. And of course, one of the things that I think comes to mind for anyone who's been watching Saudi Arabia in the last few years has been the effect of the Jamal Khashoggi murder that took place in Turkey inside of the Saudi Arabian consulate in Istanbul. How has this murder of a Saudi journalist who was working for the Washington Post, someone who should have operated under the security and safety of the umbrella of the United States, how has this murder affected the relations between the U.S. and Saudi Arabia?
There is never a story about Saudi Arabia in the Western press that doesn't mention Jamal Khashoggi. Every single story mentions it. And it is not going away. I met the Saudi ambassador to Germany when I was in Berlin last summer, and he told me that every single conversation he has with German diplomats begins with asking about Jamal Khashoggi. And so the issue is still almost the last name of MBS. It is always there for him. I think in the White House, that event has not changed the relationship. It will be other things that do. I think this oil price problem between Washington and Riyadh is going to remain a problem. Congress has always raised questions since the very beginning, and you can see that U.S. public opinion, Americans don't like the Saudis. They like the Chinese better. They like the Russians. They like the Cubans better. You can see it in polls. The relationship has always been a relationship between the White House, every White House, and the Saudis, sometimes better, sometimes worse. In the 1950s, the king came to Washington. He got a ticker tape parade down Pennsylvania Avenue. Can you imagine that today? It just could not happen. And I think that the point that Yasmin makes is that there are diverging interests between Riyadh and Washington may be exacerbated as we go on through this pandemic, and especially when we get to the part of an economic recovery, because Saudi's decisions will affect what happens in the United States.
It's no secret now that there is a problem of trust, even with the special relationship between the Crown Prince and President Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, and even President Trump himself. President Trump sees this relationship as being about money. He's always bragging that this relationship is about selling them arms. They have a lot of money that they are going to invest in the United States, which is true. But the Saudis still want more from the relationship than this kind. They want the commitment to their defense, for example, which is something that has hampered American projects, for example, like the Middle East Strategic Alliance that we've read about since 2018 and still not taking place, because the Saudis are calling for more U.S. commitment to their defense, to their military defense. And on the other hand, you have an American president saying, oh no, this is just about money. And even when I send you troops, it will be because you're paying for these troops to be there.
When MBS was rising in power, there was an understanding, and it was something that was promoted by people like Thomas Friedman, that perhaps we had a reformer and someone who was going to be able to modernize Saudi Arabia with entertainment centers and the ability to return to a pre-1979 Saudi Arabia. Is that now out the window?
That was out the window when Jamal Khashoggi was killed. His ratings went through the floor, MBS. Certainly, the American public saw him as the culprit, even if the White House did not.
And Yasmin, of course, with the revenue base for Saudi Arabia, which depends so much on oil revenue, also disappearing at a rapid pace, I imagine that some of those reforms and some of those plans that were so ambitious at the outset must be on the back burner now.
Oh, of course. And we have seen that with the decision to flood the market with oil and drive the oil prices down, the Saudi government had a directive to cut the budget of different ministries by 20%. And then you had, with the announcement of the stimulus package to manage the COVID-19 impact on the economy, the Minister of Finance stated that some of the new sectors that were actually supposed to drive the diversification of the economy away from oil are going to see their budget even more limited. I'm talking, for example, about tourism, about entertainment. So definitely it's going to take a hit because it's not only about the COVID impact. It's not only about the oil prices. You know, the pilgrimage, whether seasonal pilgrimage or the annual pilgrimage, is a huge source of revenue for the Saudis. So they are under a lot of economic strain in addition to the war in Yemen that they are trying to put an end to.
I'd like to thank both of our guests today for participating. Deborah Amos, thank you. Also, thank you to Yasmin Farouk of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace.
Thank you.
Thank you.
With millions of Americans shuttered inside, not taking trips, commuting, or flying, the world's demand for oil has plummeted.
Demand for crude has dried up.
At the same time, a price war between Saudi Arabia and Russia has caused oil supply to go through the roof. The expected surplus is so large that Saudi Arabia is running out of places to store the oil.
Supertankers have become floating oil storage tanks for tens of millions of barrels of oil.
The global oil market is volatile, to say the least. Oil has gone from rock-bottom pricing to the highest ever one-day increase per barrel, all within the span of a few days. America seeks dramatic production cuts to raise prices, and Donald Trump is inserting himself into the rift between Saudi Arabia and Russia.
It has ravaged an industry worldwide, not here, I mean worldwide. The oil industry has been ravaged.
Huge volatility is the new normal, and unstable oil markets reflect destabilizing geopolitics. And while oil may be chiefly responsible for today's climate change problems, it's also a way to take the temperature of the world's political health. Jim Crane is here to help us sort it out. He's a fellow for energy studies at Rice University's Baker Institute in Houston. Previously, he was Persian Gulf correspondent for the Associated Press and is the author of City of Gold, Dubai, and the Dream of Capitalism. So I'd like to welcome you to the program, Jim Crane. So Jim, you were listening in on our previous segment on Saudi Arabia. You specialize in energy issues and you watch the geopolitics of oil and energy. How do you look at Saudi Arabia?
Saudi Arabia is kind of a special place in the oil sector, in global oil. It is, so it's the number one exporter. It's one of the three largest producers, along with Russia and the United States. But it is the only country in the world that maintains spare oil production capacity. So at any given time, it keeps between 1 and 2 million barrels a day of oil production in abeyance that it doesn't use. And so this is really important. This is one of the, you know, it allows it to use that spare capacity when there's a demand spike, and it brings that oil production capacity online and reduces volatility in oil markets. And it does that for its own best interest because it wants oil to remain the world's most viable transportation fuel, and it wants it to be able to compete against alternate fuels and technologies. But that's also one of the reasons that it is such an important country to the United States. I mean, it's being the number one exporter, but also using that spare capacity in concert with U.S. Foreign policy goals. So when the U.S. invades Iraq, say, or when there's an outage in Libya, or when Iraq invades Kuwait, the Saudis will bring that spare capacity online. And, prices at the pump won't move nearly as much as they would otherwise, when there's such an outage of a big country. So we're seeing that now with Iran, the U.S. sanctions on Iran. We do those types of policies in concert with Saudi Arabia, and the Saudis bring extra oil production online, and you know, the U.S. can maintain this kind of aggressive foreign policy without antagonizing its own motorists. So it's one of the key things that makes the kingdom, gives it more geopolitical power than it otherwise might have.
Right. And in that geopolitical framework, you know, you often hear that as oil exports from other countries, or as the price of oil drops when the United States starts developing and achieving such major levels of production itself, that perhaps the Middle East is not as important to American foreign policy strategy as it once was.
Well, that's right. So there's a lot of folks that are questioning whether or not the U.S. still needs to spend $100 billion a year protecting the Saudi Arabia and the other Persian Gulf monarchies from threats to the region. I mean, it is a pretty rough region. There's a lot of conflict there. There's a lot of small, weak powers that are, they're, you know, vying for supremacy, and there's wars, you know, some of which are linked back to oil and others which are not. But, you know, we're watching the rise of China, and there's a lot of thinking in Washington that says, you know, we're spending way too much time and attention and money on a part of the world where we have fewer and fewer economic links with. We've all but stopped importing oil from that part of the world, and we still bring in some Saudi crude, but that's mainly because Saudi Arabia owns the largest oil refinery in the United States, here in Texas. So that refinery just happens to be configured around Saudi crude. Otherwise, we may not be importing any crude from that part of the world anymore. Saudi Arabia is proving itself that it's maintains a, you know, still has a really big presence in oil markets, and it can sometimes use that presence, and it's the same spare capacity that it uses to reduce volatility. It can also use that to cause volatility in oil markets. So when the kingdom feels that it's being taken for granted, or it's being taken advantage of, and it's, you know, by cutting production, it is allowing other producers, and in this case, the United States, to free ride on its cuts and to take advantage of those cuts, it can use that spare capacity as a deterrent or to punish these other producers that are not cutting back and that are free riding on its cuts. So that's one of the things that we're seeing here with this price war, is that the Saudis and the Russians in this case are watching as the United States has surpassed them in oil production output. You know, sooner or later, I think we were going to see them take action. And then, you know, through the sort of convoluted dynamic of OPEC, that has certainly taken place. Unfortunately, it's taken place in the midst of a demand shock that just keeps getting worse.
Right. So let's talk a little bit about that demand shock. Obviously, the coronavirus has slowed down economic activity around the world. For those of us who drive around still in on the freeways, it's impossible not to note that the price at the pump has dropped dramatically. This means that, in fact, there is just way too much oil on the market, way too little revenue coming in to the Saudis, and of course to the Russians as a result of this dropping price of the cost of a barrel of oil to just somewhere around $20 a barrel.
Yeah, that's right. Well, you've got, you know, around the world, 3 billion people who are essentially on lockdown, right? They've got serious travel restrictions. And when you can't travel, you're not using oil anymore. I mean, oil is mainly a transportation fuel. It's the fuel we use in our cars and trucks and in our planes and ships. So, yeah, there's some diesel demand, and there's still trucks and ships moving around, but people aren't really flying anymore or driving anymore. So it is, there's a huge free fall in demand. Something like, you know, there's some estimates that it's down as much as 20%, and that, you know, somewhere around 5 to 10% of global oil production is now uneconomic, you know, anywhere below $25. There's, and most of that is in the United States, by the way, or in North America, the U.S. and Canada. There's this just, you know, huge, all kinds of follow-on reactions from this, you know, oil producers cutting spending as quickly as they can and laying folks off, But there's this huge discount in gasoline that that drivers are seeing. But if you're not driving, you can't really take advantage of it. So normally, you know, with, through the action of the market, you'll usually when there's a when oil prices fall and gasoline prices fall, you'll see demand going up. But right now, that is not happening. Demand is still dropping. So it's a very strange situation.
Right. So there's a demand shock and a supply shock. And what you said is, in essence, that in some parts of the country, North America in particular, where it costs an awful lot to produce this oil, and I guess that would be in fracking or in oil sands extraction to try and, as opposed to punching a hole in the ground and watching the oil flow up. Those are very different types of production realities.
Yeah, that's right. So, you know, Saudi costs per barrel are somewhere around $8 or $10, and that includes their capital investment costs. You know, here in the U.S., it's 3 to 4 times that. I mean, it varies depending on the region and on the company and their cost of capital, et cetera. Things were looking dicey in the shale patch with oil at $50. Lots of companies were not generating any free cash flow. They weren't, you know, they weren't making any profit on top of all their expenses and investment.
So while the demand is something that's very difficult to manage for the Saudis or any other oil producer, supply really, as you've noted, is the one accelerator or decelerator that you have seen used, in particular by the Saudis in the past, to manage that price of oil. By the way, for those who lived through the 70s and we recall the power of OPEC and the ability to manage that supply and to manage it to the extent that they could really create what we referred to back then as the oil crisis, the oil shortage that that was worldwide. I think it's interesting to see that maybe perhaps we're seeing a weakening of that cartel, of the OPEC system, and maybe even the first inkling of outright conflict within the OPEC or OPEC plus countries.
Well, it's an interesting point. So some of our research at Rice has actually pointed to shale really undermining the power of the OPEC cartel. You know, this huge ramp up in U.S. oil output created so much supply that Saudi Arabia and the, you know, the other, you know, 24 members of OPEC could not on their own manage the market, balance the market with this excess supply coming from shale. So they needed one of the other big oil producers to join with it, and that's Russia. So shale, ironically, forced Saudi Arabia and Russia together. It sort of gave them common cause to act together to try and manage the market. So in a way, there's, you know, shale's caused this interesting geopolitical you know, alliance of convenience that we're seeing. It's certainly having bumps in the road now, Saudi Arabia and Russia being at odds. But a lot of that was caused by shale. Just one of the unforeseen aspects of this energy revolution here in the U.S.
So let me get this straight. The United States really values and has invested heavily in the relationship with Saudi Arabia, but because of United States shale production and the online suddenly production and availability of American energy products, it is forced in some ways energy dependent, oil production dependent Russia into a tighter relationship with Saudi Arabia.
It's true. And it, you know, these are countries that were sworn enemies in the past. You know, when the Soviet Union was still around, you know, the Saudis were in lockstep with the United States and their anti-communist doctrine coming out of the U.S. When the Soviet Union collapsed, you know, some of the strategic rationale for the U.S.-Saudi relationship began to dissolve a bit. But, you know, we've always been still pretty close partners, but now we're seeing, you know, this, you know, previously unthinkable Russia-Saudi alliance. And that's because shale producers, you know, there is no state control of the oil sector in the United States. Like in most of the world, you know, oil is owned by the state. It's owned by the people. In the United States alone, it's, you know, mineral rights are owned by the whoever owns the surface land. So you've got hundreds or thousands of companies, some of them tiny, all taking their orders from the market. They're not listening to governments or, you know, much less OPEC. They're looking for market signals. And when they see the price is high enough, they bring more oil. They drill and they bring more oil to market, which is intensely frustrating for the Saudis and for OPEC, because that takes away their ability to constrain global production and prop up prices. So what was happening was you were getting the Saudis making deeper and deeper cuts and getting the Russians and others to join in. They had made 1.7 million barrels a day of cuts, taking, you know, almost 2% of global oil off the market. And the United States just kept producing more and more. So basically free riding on the backs of these OPEC cuts, on the sacrifices made by OPEC. You know, so it's an interesting story. It's, you know, the dynamics of the oil market at work. And, you know, if you're Russia, Saudi, you know, oil strategists, at some point, you're not going to continue to put up with that. And I think that's what we saw with the price war.
And do you think also, you know, you just talked about the private ownership of oil and oil production in the United States, but it's not as if the state, the government doesn't have any role to play. There are strategic oil reserves. There's the ability to put more or less of that oil reserve on the international marketplace, in the energy markets themselves. How do those U.S. oil reserves affect the pricing and the strategic use of energy products to manage their relationships with whether it be Russia or Saudi Arabia?
So the Strategic Petroleum Reserve is, you know, generally brought to bear in an emergency. It's something that you can be called upon when oil prices spike, you know, really high, or there's you know, a country goes out, there's a civil war, or, you know, the Strait of Hormuz is blocked and there's no way for oil to get to market. So it's supposed to be reserved for that. You know, there's 77 million barrels of storage that's still available in the Strategic Petroleum Reserve right now, and it seems like a good time to fill it and give the U.S. producers a little break by buying that oil domestically. I tend to think of the U.S. government as sort of a third-rate player in oil and in energy in the U.S. I mean, I think most of the signals and most of the marching orders come from the market, and then after that, it's states, state and local regulators. So here in Texas, you know, we've got the Texas Railroad Commission, that's our local market regulator. You know, some states are friendlier and some states are less friendly. I think the last really big energy policy decision that really had a big impact on the oil sector in the federal government was under President Obama, when he lifted the oil export ban. Kind of bizarrely, the U.S. oil producers were prohibited from exporting crude oil and could only export products. And with this huge ramp up in shale, President Obama lifted those restrictions. But we haven't seen the Trump administration doing anything nearly as dramatic yet.
Well, it's interesting to see how the U.S. as a government is not a central player. Certainly, that's not the case in Russia. It's not the case in Iran or in Saudi Arabia. Perhaps as we look out over the next few years, do you expect the United States government to engage in a more active way in any way? Or is this something that it's pretty much fixed in its current dynamic?
Sooner or later, I think, the U.S. government's going to have to take action on climate. And I think through climate, through environmental policy, we'll see some stronger regulation of fossil fuels, probably first coal, and then oil and natural gas. But if we're going to do anything on climate change, that's going to have to come from the federal government through a carbon tax or some kind of cap and trade agreement that really starts to curtail oil demand in the U.S. I think that's probably the main area.
Well, certainly it would require not just American action, but also China would be central, whether it be on the consumer level or at a state level, to also be effective on the world stage and to join the United States and other countries if they were in fact serious about acting on climate issues.
Oh, that's right, of course. I mean, so China's the number one current emitter of greenhouse gases. U.S. is number two. The U.S. is the largest historic emitter, so most of the greenhouse gases that are being stored up in the atmosphere, or the largest share of them, I should say, are were combusted, related to combustion here in the U.S. China's the number two historic emitter. So the U.S. is number one or number two in both of those categories. We've got the largest GDP, though. We've got the largest wherewithal to reduce our emissions. There's all sorts of low-hanging fruit across the economy, including in the shale patch, where lots of natural gas is being burned off as waste at the wellhead right now. And that is one way that the oil industry could step up and take a greater responsibility for what it does. Until the U.S. takes some firm and serious action on climate, I think you're going to have a hard time convincing China or other big emitters to follow suit. I think a lot of this hinges on us taking serious steps.
Very good. Thank you, Jim Crane.
Thanks for having me on, Marcos.
That was Jim Crane. He's a scholar at the Center for Energy Studies at Rice University in Houston. As we referenced earlier in my conversation with Yasmeen Farouk and Deb Amos, Saudi Arabia has injected itself into a crushing war in neighboring Yemen. The conflict is entering its sixth year, and the COVID-19 pandemic could escalate an already dire humanitarian crisis. Producer Teresa Katsourilis called Peter Salisbury to find out more. He's a senior analyst at the International Crisis Group.
In 2012, I was in Yemen, and I traveled out to the Red Sea coast of Yemen. And that's the first place that I saw a malnourished child. I saw a little girl who was about 2 years old, who looked like she was less than a year, distended stomach, and talked to her mother, who was already in a place where she couldn't afford to eat. That was 8 years ago. That was before this war.
That's been dubbed one of the worst humanitarian crises of our time.
5 years of conflict have killed at least 100,000 people.
Amid relentless bombings, many parents here cannot afford to even feed their kids.
When I think about what's happened since then, I dread to think what has come of her and her daughter.
So how have these years of war and conflict impacted Yemen's healthcare system?
People are getting sick from preventable diseases. Cholera has been a huge problem in Yemen the last few years. A lot of hospitals, a lot of clinics are basically run by people who, in effect, are acting as volunteers and keeping things going themselves. International non-governmental organizations have also played a big role in propping up the healthcare system. But really, you're talking about something that was woefully inadequate for about the sort of 28-odd million people that are in Yemen before, running on not even a shoestring budget, but trying to run on air at this point in time.
So as of this recording, there aren't any reported cases of COVID-19 in Yemen. That doesn't mean it's not there, of course, given the state of the healthcare system you just described. Could you walk us through the worst case scenario here? What could happen?
The worst case scenario for COVID really is that the fighting continues. So it's difficult to get people in and out of the country to help coordinate a response, but also so that we've got sort of people coming in out of the big towns and cities from the front lines, spreading what they might have caught on the front lines in the cities and vice versa. At the very least, halting the fighting would make a nationwide response easier. But even then, look, this is a choice between a very, very bad situation for Yemen and a really just terrible, disastrous situation for Yemen.
One of the things that makes the war in Yemen so complicated, of course, is that it has taken on certain proxy war dimensions. Saudi Arabia and Iran are both involved in funding different parties. Both of those countries are also getting hit by this pandemic to varying degrees right now. And so have you seen their strategies change at all in this conflict, particularly with an even worse humanitarian crisis on the horizon?
COVID-19, with a bit of luck, does create more pressure on Saudi Arabia because it knows that internationally, if an outbreak happens in Yemen and a lot of people die there, it will be held to account for its part in the war, for what's happening in Yemen. For Iran, I wouldn't say there's a great deal of incentive for this them to change their strategy on Yemen. I'd imagine they're pretty focused on their own internal issues right now. But for Saudi Arabia, I think there has to be an acknowledgement there that this is just going to be sort of a bigger part of the same problem. And it's also an opportunity to save face for Saudi Arabia, for the Houthis, the rebels. It creates a greater purpose for the different parties involved in the conflict, for finishing it, for ending it. That's the very optimistic view. But unfortunately, their behavior thus far in the conflict has not been encouraging on that front.
Saudi Arabia's Air Defense Force say it intercepted and destroyed a ballistic missile over the capital on Saturday.
The UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres asked the parties to stop the fighting. The UN has been trying to mediate a ceasefire.
Our world faces a common enemy, COVID-19. It is time to put armed conflict on lockdown and focus together on the true fight of our lives.
But when we move towards a ceasefire, we do tend to see an escalation in all aspects of the conflict. And the bigger question for me is whether or not they're willing to make the compromises needed to push us into a ceasefire.
In the middle of all this, the United States appears to actually be cutting quite a bit of their healthcare aid to Yemen. How do you think that could impact this conflict and a potential COVID-19 outbreak in this country?
The timing is definitely not good. The U.S. has its reasons for pushing for a halt to funding to humanitarian operations in the north of the country. Multiple very credible reports at the end of last year of aid diversion in Houthi-controlled areas and fears in the U.S. the money it's spending in Yemen is actually being used to help perpetuate a war against its ally, Saudi Arabia. I think the concern and the conversation that people in the humanitarian space have been having is that there are ways of negotiating this, and it's a gradual drawdown in aid, not a complete halt. It's just this sudden stop. People don't have time to find ways to replace US funding. And also, you're already seeing layoffs within international NGOs and NGOs inside Sana'a in the north of the country, and people really desperately searching for work there.
So we're seeing layoffs at international aid organizations at the exact moment when, ideally, aid organizations in Yemen should be ramping up to respond to this crisis.
Exactly correct, yeah.
I can imagine, as someone who's focused on this for many years, there is a reason you keep going back there, and that it stretches beyond the worst things that can possibly happen there. So is there something about the country, the culture, the people you've met that keep you coming back?
I'm sure lots of other people say this about the countries they work on, but people who end up working on Yemen tend to be obsessives. And it's mainly because it's one of the friendliest and most welcoming and in many ways silliest places. And to have spent time there is really sort of one of the great pleasures of my professional life.
All right, Peter, thank you so much for sitting down and discussing this with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
You've been listening to World Affairs. That was Teresa Katsourilas in conversation with Peter Salisbury. He's senior Yemen analyst at the International Crisis Group. Earlier, Marcos Kounoulakis spoke with Jim Crane, Deb Amos, and Yasmin Farouk about Saudi Arabia and the international oil market. We know that what gets many of us through the seemingly endless days of sheltering in are connection, perspective, community, and facts. To hear this episode or any other World Affairs program, you can download our podcast on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Search for World Affairs. That's one word. World Affairs is produced in partnership with KQED. It's made possible by the generous support of Chevron and TPG. Marcos Kounoulakis hosted this week's episode. Our technical supervisor is Jim Bennett. Our senior producer is Jared Sport. Our producer is Teresa Katsourilas. Julia Kwadnitsa and Tatum Sanderback assisted with research. And our executive producer is Joanne Jennings. I'm Philip Yun. Thank you for joining us.